So I've got something exciting to share. My book, What Are You Thirsty For? Rethinking Alcohol and the Life You Want, is now available for pre-order. It's about rethinking your drinking, not because you necessarily have to, but because deep down you know there's more waiting on the other side. It's about creating space for clarity, for calm, and the version of you that doesn't need alcohol to cope. So if you're looking for a refreshing take on alcohol identity and desire, just tap the link in the show notes and pre-order. Right, let's get on with the episode. Welcome to the Big Drink Rethink, the podcast for anyone questioning their relationship with alcohol or simply wondering what more life might hold. I'm Anna Donaghy, alcohol mindset coach, author, and former strategist. And each episode is going to blend lived experience, psychological insight, and powerful tools to help you understand your habits and gently rethink your drinking in a way that throws open oodles of possibilities. So whether you're trying to quit, cut down, or you're just plain curious, then you are in the right place. Let's rethink things together and explore what you're really thirsty for. Hello, hello, and welcome back to the Big Drink Rethink, where I want to start talking about a new theme, actually, and one that I really love. The theme is nourishment and what that really means, you know, beyond food. So I'm talking about those deeper ingredients that help us feel fulfilled and really thrive. Things like purpose, things like connection, things like creativity. The things that are individual to all of us, granted, but if we make sure that they're part of our diet, part of our day, a regular part of our life, they feed us. And they make sure that we don't feel like we're in a perpetual state of depletion and in need of a drink come the evening. In fact, they're often the answer to the question, what am I really thirsty for? And to start to explore and unpack that, I'm being joined in the studio by Dan D'Souza, who is co-founder of Mush, a lion's mane-based drinks brand. Dan's here to talk about his story because it really captures for me the grey area that we so often find ourselves in with alcohol. So many people sit in this grey area. We're going to talk about what happens when drinking isn't a crisis, but it also isn't nothing. Going to talk about how Dan realized cutting down wasn't good enough, so he chose to stop, and how that decision opened up space for purpose, for nourishment, and even the birth of that business, Mush. So Dan stopped drinking in October 2023, was working in previous businesses, and he felt there was a need for more functional and non-alcoholic drinks. So Mush was born to bridge what he and his partner saw as a gap between taste and function. It is delicious. I can vouch for both taste and function. But I'm going to leave Dan to talk about all of that. We're going to start off hopefully at the beginning, Dan. I'd love to welcome you first of all. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me on, Anna. It's a topic that I'm very passionate about. So it's great to talk about it.
No, well, it is great. And thank you for your time, because I know as a sort of busy business founder, early stages of growth, how hectic things are. But let's dive straight in. Why don't we start by you giving listeners a bit of your backstory? So, you know, you've had this fascinating mix of career experiences. And can you share a little bit about, you know, what life has looked like for you on your way to where you are today?
Yeah. So in a nutshell, me and my business partner met at university. So we met at the University of Leeds. And I very quickly realized in my university dream, it's an interesting time for everyone. I think a time where people are drinking a lot of alcohol, or typically were in that era, the 2009 era. And we met back then, a time when we were both drinking lots and having lots of fun. And it was a pivotal time where you're trying to learn about yourself. You're trying to learn about your direction in life and figuring a lot of things out along the way. And so that year I decided to go to Leeds on the course Maths with Finance, which was not the course that I originally applied for, which was economics. I missed my grades, unfortunately. So I had an absolutely fantastic year, but realized through that year that actually Sussex doing marketing was the way for me to go, and hence the direction I've taken ever since then. And sometimes those hard decisions have to happen via experience, and sometimes you've got to learn things on the way and and sort of run into roadblocks, as it were. So that was a big, big learning curve. Went on to Sussex to study marketing, and through that course ended up finding my passion ultimately. And it's really been marketing ever since. So studied that degree, and within that degree also did a year of Virgin Holidays as part of their marketing team, and then went on to a whole string of finance and asset management related things. So always within marketing, typically within content, CRM, all sorts of different places. And throughout that experience, really, alcohol always played a big part. So whether it was at school, you know, even to the back end of school, whether it was at university, what one would probably describe as binge drinking during areas like Freshers Week, and you know, obviously lessening that towards the end of the degree, but still alcohol playing a key role. And then moving out to New York for a year, where I got the opportunity to work at Citibank, studying a postgrad certificate. Again, alcohol played a big part, and there was this constant working hard, playing hard culture that was certainly drilled into my generation. And I think whilst things are shifting now, throughout that era from school to university to living in New York to coming back to London and working in finance, working in asset management, alcohol always played a big role in that. In terms of networking, in terms of socializing, in terms of dating, it pretty much was a big part of every element of that. And so that experience, as you mentioned, sort of I found myself at Octopus and Octopus Investments, really loved what I'd been doing there, really, really enjoyed that business and had come on leaps and bounds in terms of my own marketing career. But in the back of my mind, I'd always been thinking to myself, I want something more than this. You know, this is a great company and they're doing amazing things, but I've always wanted to start something myself. And what does that look like? So that was my mindset in 2019. And at the end of 2019, my business partner and I, Matt, started chatting about working together. And we'd known each other since, you know, over 10 years at that point. And we were thinking, what could we possibly do? And that's where we started talking about our first business, which was Howling Owl, which is an events and hospitality company. And yeah, that's launched that in January 2020. COVID hit very soon afterwards and totally changed the game on that. So yeah, that was an interesting experience. A pivotal one, and one where we learned how to change direction, change tack pretty quickly. And that business is still running today, 5 and a bit years later. And through that process, as you mentioned, we identified the new opportunity in the functional drinks and non-alcoholic drink space, which gave rise to Mush. And a bit over 2 years later, well, actually almost bang on 2 years now, we're sort of still going strong and growing and lots of exciting things happening. So I'm looking forward to that journey that we're on and seeing where that ends up. And as you said, very, very busy at the moment and just trying to do all sorts of different things in various different areas. So yeah, lots of exciting stuff.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Very dynamic. Very, I like it, you know, sort of various pivots, but also there's clearly, you know, you sort of meandered through from university to, you know, New York to investment banking and also, you know, you have some very, as you say, very, very boozy environments, very boozy cultures. I'm just paying homage to the freshers who would have just finished a brain, a terribly depleting week before they've even started their lectures at this time of year as we are recording this now. It's brutal. So looking back, and obviously there's quite a lot of stages of your career there, so you might need to cherry pick a little bit, but looking back, what patterns around drinking were you absorbing from those environments? I mean, there's the independence and we're all in this together kind of gay kind of abandonment of university. And then there's the sort of the networking of the city and the, you know, the play hard, work hard environment vibe of New York. I mean, what kind of patterns were you absorbing and what jobs were you giving alcohol to do at various stages, do you think?
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of alcohol for me was like that social lubrication. Mm. It was making it easier to go out and socialize. You know, I would consider myself on the ambiverted part of the kind of extrovert introvert spectrum. I do get energy from spending time with people that I get on with, but I also find sometimes those really intense environments quite draining at points, being honest. And I do enjoy time on my own as well, but a good balance of the two. And certainly going into those big environments, whether it be New York, you're meeting, you know, tens of people every time you're going out, having all these conversations, or whether it be a work related thing where you're trying to build relationships with more senior people, you're trying to push your career forwards. There was almost an expectation around drinking, and if people weren't drinking, it was something that was slightly odd. When I look around now, I think there's still an element to which there's an expectation of drinking. You know, even the conversations that we're having with investors, there's still an understanding that these deals that happen, a lot of these deals are linked to alcohol. You need to go out and stay out till X in the morning, have a few drinks, everyone eases up, and everyone starts, you know, really get to know each other in theory. So even now, I feel, you know, now that I don't drink, there's still a line which I can't necessarily participate in. And I'm comfortable with that decision, you know, that for me was inherent to making that change and inherent to the mission that we're on. But I do recognize that it can be a limiting factor. So yeah, I think it's definitely social lubrication. I think ultimately for me, it was a bit of a crutch. It made those situations better. Even now, you know, I think for me, feeling the situations that have become harder shows me the places where it was the biggest crutch. So I think about a wedding where I haven't seen people in 10 years or so. That situation is probably going to be awkward regardless. You know, these people, at some point, you knew them really, really well. And some of them you still know really well, you see all the time. But people that you haven't seen in 10 years, how do you catch up in 10 years worth of your life quickly? You can't. And particularly when you're going around and speaking to loads of different people, or you're on a table with people you've never met before, there's an element to which that probably just will be quite awkward, unless you're
the table from hell at a wedding or something.
Yeah, exactly. And we've all had them. We've all had tables where we've had fantastic people next to us, where we've ended up making a new best friend. And we've had other times where we're sat next to someone we think, I wish the ground would swallow me up right now.
Where you've just decided your C-list.
Exactly.
Overflow table.
Exactly. And yeah, and particularly if you've got one on either side of you as well. Usually it's at least 50% good. But I think we can all recognize those situations, and alcohol can just be that thing that eases things through. And I think
it does,
for me,
it is.
Yeah. And I think even now, in another example, I sometimes get invited to karaoke. And I'll be honest, I dread it. I dread singing in public. And I think alcohol for me was definitely easing me through those situations. Now, I think those examples are probably extreme examples. You're not going to weddings every day. You're not getting asked to do karaoke every day. But it illustrates the wider theme of alcohol helping you through those situations.
Yeah, for sure. I was actually, you know, I'm not going to get distracted by this, but I was writing a LinkedIn post this morning, and it's, you know, it's that classic, you know, we bonded over beers. And you kind of go, did you really bond, or did you just both avoid the awkwardness over beers, you know? But it is nonetheless what we do, and it's what greases the wheels, as you say, of a lot of deals, a lot of networking events, a lot of small talk, you know, which we're just not that confident with. So yeah, I get it. So things were rolling along for you. They were, you had this wonderful new business venture underway, and you started to look at your drinking. So what was beginning to feel the drift for you? What prompted that for you?
I think for me, the biggest thing was sort of escalating consequences, I guess, of, you know, going out, whether that be worrying that you'd said something to offend someone and you're sort of feeling socially anxious in the morning, whether it be hangovers getting worse and, you know, you feeling worse. I think more generally, I could feel my health declining over the years. I think if I took a sort of bird's eye view, I'd be amazed at how my body was changing and how I just didn't feel as good as I did. You know, when I was drinking when I was 18, you bounce back so quickly. You're drinking mid-30s and it's a different story. So I think the consequences in that sense, and, you know, consequences of nights out in general, and they were just escalating more and more. Things were getting worse. My skin was getting worse. I've suffered with eczema my entire life, and I was noticing that after drinking, you know, I'd rip my skin to pieces. And I just think over time, you start to see these things escalating. And to some extent, you know, either you don't maybe recognize it, or you just put it to the back of your mind, and you're so involved in this cycle that it doesn't necessarily sort of break the surface to you. But slowly these things were getting more and more and more. And I thought to myself, it's starting to have a significant impact. And more than that, I'm on this journey of starting my own business. Starting a business is hard. It's really, really hard. Anyone who's done it, and probably people who have known people who've done it, can attest to that. And when you're trying to go on that hard journey, if you really believe in what you're trying to do, then you want to try and take out as many impediments as possible. You want to try and give yourself the best possible chance of making a success of it. And over time, I was thinking to myself, you know, I'm optimizing lots and lots of things here, but there's this one big element that I'm not optimizing. And I'm finding myself, after a Friday night of drinking and or a Saturday night of drinking, feeling really foggy headed Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, even Wednesday a bit. And then by Thursday, Friday, I'm starting to feel better, only to do the whole thing again. And the wider theme of just wanting to optimize, wanting to be better, wanting to go after these dreams that I was starting on the pathway of, I just thought there's a big opportunity here. There's a big opportunity. And I'm excited to see what could be on the other side of it.
No, it is exciting. And it's also amazing that you noticed it, because, you know, a lot of people don't. I feel really strongly about this. I think, you know, even if drinking isn't a big problem in the way that we would define problem drinking as a society, if it's sort of depleting you in important parts of life, it's a problem. Yeah. You know, it's a small p problem, isn't it? It's an issue if it's compromising you, particularly if you're, you know, waking up and feeling a bit shit, or you're sitting in meetings when you know you've got to kind of be on the ball, but you're feeling a bit distracted, or whatever it might be. It's, you know, it's an issue. And we get to define what that issue is as well. We get to define and say, well, I just don't feel good enough. And this isn't good enough. This isn't going to get me where I want to get to. I think a lot of people, I certainly put up with, you know, a high degree of suboptimal for a long time. And I kept myself, oh, well, it's because you're not in your 20s anymore, you're bound to feel older. Oh, well, you're a young man now, you're bound to feel tired. Or you're in your 40s now, getting old, you know, and you just, you can pass it off. You can keep passing it off. You can stop and listen and go, this isn't good enough. You know, I want more, I need more, I deserve more, whichever one of those you kind of want to apply. So it doesn't necessarily sound as though there was a moment, a singular moment, and certainly not a rock bottom or anything like that in the sort of the clinical sense. But there was a problem for you in terms of you wanting to build the life that you wanted to build, yeah?
Yeah, and I think, I mean, you know, there's always some sort of turning moment, isn't there? I think for me, I made the decision in October. That was the date I have written on my whiteboard at home, the 2nd of October, 2023. So we're literally about to come up to 2 years of it. There was a night where there were consequences of, I lost a bag which had my phone and my laptop in it after a night of drinking. And, you know, it's not the worst thing. I wasn't injured or anything like that. And there wasn't, you know, anything particularly horrendous. But, you know, those kind of things, you just think, well, these consequences are getting worse. And what could happen next? And, do I want to be, like, particularly as a business owner, you know, at the point of business that I was at, I'm not making crazy amounts of money. A new laptop, and, you know, I'm part of the Apple crew. So a new laptop costs you a fair bit, doesn't it? And I think,
of course, and the inconvenience of the whole thing, you know, it's just, and then underlying all of that, this kind of gnawing sense, you know, you prat. It's literally, isn't it? It's that sense of, and I did this. Yeah. I wasn't mugged. You know, no prize is out of my hands. I've left this in a taxi, or I've left it in a bar, or I've left it somewhere, and it's a mess. Yeah,
exactly.
Absolutely.
And I think, sort of adding to your point before, I had already been, start of 2023, I'd already been testing my toe in the water of drinking less, you know, basically for the first few months, I can't remember exactly what it was in 2023, but sort of for 3-4 months, I said, you know, I'm gonna go sober, try it out and see how it goes, which I did. And I've started to notice some of the benefits. And really, I mean, the great thing about things like Dry Jan is championing that message. I think after a month, you really haven't seen all the benefits that you could see. And I think particularly if you've been drinking for as long as I had, you know, if you've been drinking relatively medium to relatively heavy for 15 odd years, you know, that's 15 of years of accrued sort of damage to the body, so to speak. And so you quit for a month, you're not going to reclaim those benefits. But if you quit for a year, you quit for 2 years, and part of our core message at Mush is this concept of one small step, right? So you don't necessarily have to say, I'm going to quit for a year, because that's a huge amount. I'm going to quit forever. But starting one month at a time, so you start with Dry January as an example, then you're like, okay, I'm just going to not drink for another month. Okay, how about another month again? And then you're like, well, maybe if I've done 3 months, maybe I can do 6 months. And just keep going. It's just not drinking for that next weekend initially, or that next day initially.
I think it's a brilliant approach to the whole thing. You heard me shamelessly plugging my sort of big drink rethink experiment. Oh, just done it again. I really, really emphasize in that a month off is a good amount of time for you to sort of assess what your relationship with booze is really like and how hard you find that month and what it brought up for you. But that's the sort of, that's the hard work end of things. If you can continue beyond that, then the benefits just keep coming thick and fast and thick and fast. But it never, ever has to be with that kind of crazy commitment that makes your brain flip out of, is this it now? You know, is this forever? It's like, no, if it feels good, carry on. And it will feel good, by the way. But, you know, carry on and carry on doing more of what feels good and more of what feels kind. And before you know it, you've put, you know, quite a long stint in there, which is brilliant. You know, so it's a very, very good way of doing it instead of just doing the whole white knuckling. It's just use it to learn. I think it's really important as well to talk about that sort of grey area drinking, which, you know, it's a term that a US sobriety coach called Jolene Parks coined. And I genuinely think that a lot of people in the UK who drink have this kind of relationship with booze where it's just a bit murky. You know, the lines are blurred. It hasn't wrecked your life, but it's dimming it. You know, you don't drink every day, but when you do, it's kind of a bit more than you possibly intended. You leave your laptop bag somewhere. Oh, okay, well, you know, so it happens to most people at some point. I'm a bit uncomfortable with that, though. Doesn't quite feel like an issue, but it's subtly affecting you in ways that eventually, if you're tuned in, you can kind of go, is this good enough? You know, is this it? And there'll be lots of people listening to this who are kind of going, oh, I think that might be me. Yes. You know, possibly, because there's very, 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 I think a vast number of people who drink have got that kind of relationship. So I'm interested to know what immediate benefits you felt that you can sort of dangle in front of other people as a motivation to give, you know, sort of sober October or this coming January a bit of a go.
Yeah, I think, I mean, immediate benefits, I think very quickly, you know, just starting with the basics, not having hangovers in your life almost straight away is, for me, absolutely fantastic, because it really occurred to me that things were building, like life admin type things are building. And I always think of it as like, if you've got a really messy room, trying to focus on work is really, really difficult. If life is a mess and what you're doing is going out and drinking and taking yourself out of it, you're not going to be able to focus on enjoying things if you've got so much else going on. So for me, not having those hangovers just as an initial start was just great to start planning. To start planning what I was going to do, planning how I was going to improve things, and then slowly start implementing. And I think you'd be amazed how, well, I mean, you wouldn't, but one would be amazed how with that freedom, you can start fixing these things over time.
I love that. I love the mess. I love an analogy, full stop. You can listen to the back series of this podcast and it's just like analogy after analogy. It's quite embarrassing. But the messy room analogy really works for me. I think it's you know, it sounds like, you know, you were creating space. You know, the sort of the immediate benefit post hangovers and all that sort of stuff was, you know, creating the space for you to just think and take stock. And it sounds, obviously, you're on a man on a mission with business opportunities and stuff like that, but it gave you an opportunity to sit down and kind of go, what do I want to do next? And I always find it really lovely, fascinating, but almost inevitable how removing alcohol doesn't just sort of close one chapter, it always opens up another. I've never spoken to anyone for whom it hasn't opened up, you know, another chapter. So this space it created for you, I suppose, was an opportunity for you to nourish yourself work-wise. And I know, obviously, from sort of exercise perspective, we've talked about that too. You sort of threw yourself into that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, at the point that I decided to quit, I think I'd probably describe myself, I mean, years by, I might have questioned this, but I think overwhelmingly I'm getting this response. I'm quite a type A type person. So where alcohol was no longer the thing I did, I needed something else to do. And at that point where I quit, I started going to the gym 4 or 5 times a week. And that became a bit of an addiction, to be honest. Unfortunately, last year I had a few different injuries which cropped up. So I've got out of the sort of focus of that now. And unfortunately, but maybe as one might expect for someone who's trying to get a new business off the ground, work has become a bit of an addiction. But it's at the moment, it's an addiction that I really enjoy, but I definitely need to achieve that balance again. But like you said, you know, whether it's fitness, whether it's music, I mean, I've been trying to teach myself how to DJ, trying and failing, but it's something that I'm passionate about. I mean, music, I've got music playing almost probably 80% of the day. So trying to learn how to do that. I've been throwing myself into Japanese. I was doing Duolingo for a long time. And then at the start of the year, I had a Japanese teacher who was trying to teach me. And again, you know, these kind of things, they're sort of lofty ambitions. I mean, it's a very difficult language for anyone who's tried, but I love it, you know. And it's as you said, it does give you that space, and it gives you space to think and think differently and start exploring those things that you'd had on that bucket list. Oh, one day I'll do this, one day I'll do that. And actually you've given yourself the space to go, oh, do you know what, I've got a weekend, I'm not doing the things I would have previously done. I'm not going to the pub, I'm not going to a bottomless brunch, I'm not going out for drinks. And you know, Sunday won't be a write-off, it won't just be a duvet day type thing. I've got space and time to do things I want. And even thinking about things that are more simple, you know, I love going for walks. I always have. We did that a lot as a family. And now it could even be going and walking on the common. I love Wimbledon Common. You know, it's one of those places in London where you really feel like you're in the middle of nowhere when you're walking through the middle with trees surrounding you. And so whether it even just be going for walks on the common, or spending time with family, spending time with friends, going to see films on my own sometimes, or even enjoying the things that I used to do in a different way. So I've always enjoyed going out for food. Food's a real sort of soft part of mine. So going out for but you know, not spending money on the alcohol side. And actually, non-alcoholic drinks are often much more reasonably priced than alcohol.
Well, this is it.
Yeah. And so, you know, suddenly when you're not spending so much money on the alcohol, you can maybe spend more money on the food side. And, you know, I think the saving money thing is definitely a benefit. I would say for me, I probably end up spending that money on different things. So I don't necessarily save, but I spend my money more purposefully, and it's more directed at things that I want to spend it on. And where before I might have looked at my bank balance in the morning and thought, oh gosh, I didn't realize I spent that much on X rounds of drinks. Now I think, well, I spent a fair amount of money on that dinner, but it was a dinner I really wanted to have and I really enjoyed it. It was a restaurant that had been on my list for ages, or it was an activity that I, you know, wanted to do for ages. Or I've bought some new DJ decks, for example, but it's about learning this new skill. And then once I've got them, I've got them. And so it's just being more purposeful around spending, I guess.
So just gonna, as an aside, because this scared the bejesus, well, it made me go, holy moly. About sort of 6 years ago, 6 years ago, when I was giving up booze, I did a back of a fag packet calculation on the amount of money that I'd spent on booze in my lifetime. And it was conservative. I did a conservative calculation. I was working on the fact that I sort of spend a bottle of wine a night, so £7, was on a bottle of wine was about £7. I worked out that it was roughly, say, £70 a week. And this is just drinking at home, right? This is before you go. This is why it was a conservative thing. About £70 a week, about £280-300 a month, which is bonkers. Then you throw in the Christmases, the holidays, the summer holidays, the high days, all those times you eat out, you're paying, you know, out of home prices. Anyway, I'll cut to the chase. I got to about £4,000 to £5,000 a year.
Gosh. Now,
and I remain in the conservative camp there. I then worked out that over a drinking career of about 30 years, I'd spent about £150,000.
My goodness.
So quitting now, or when I did, with the equivalent amount of time ahead of me, I was able to sit there and say this one decision could probably save me between £150,000 and £200,000 over the course of the remaining part of my life. And that's before you start throwing in lost laptops,
lost
phones, taxis home because you can't drive, all sorts of shenanigans, gym memberships that you waste, all that sort of stuff. I swear to God, it was that much money. And it
I can believe it. And as you say, that's probably conservative as well. And if one takes that and says, well, even if you just do something super simple, which everyone could do, and invested that money into your pension or your ISA or whatever that may be, or you invest into yourself, you invest into your business, you invest into learning new skills, you invest into things you love doing, £150,000 could, that invested in the right way, whether it be skills, whether it be investments, could change your life. And
could change your life, exactly. And it's one of those things where I just think, you know, I can't undo what I spent and drank. I can't. I can certainly sit there and go, goodness me, what kind of truly nourishing and truly restorative experiences might I have had instead? But I can't dwell on that, but I can certainly plan them. I can plan them now and think to myself, you know, congratulate myself that I'm not spending or drinking away the same amount of, you know, booze now, and that if I therefore wish to invest in a spa a couple of days or something like that, then in effect I'm quids in and doing something which is truly nourishing. But so you've got some space, you've got some time, you've got some clarity, you've got some money. How did you go about prioritizing? Because you like a lot of stuff. You like walking on the common, speaking Japanese, eating out, learning to be a DJ, building businesses, being a family man. How did you learn where to focus? Because I think that's quite important as well, isn't it? Not to try and scatter around doing everything, optimizing everything.
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think there's real importance to trying to strike a balance there. When I initially quit drinking, I would definitely say I optimized too much to the extreme of trying to do everything all at once. And I think over the last year, I started seeing therapists at the start of the year. And that has, through those conversations, I mean, firstly, you know, it's been transformative. But secondly, it's allowed me to go, do you know what? Like, there is important to strike that balance. But in terms of how I started doing a quarterly review with myself, which sounds a bit formal. It's not as formal as it sounds. But I would
a quarterly review with myself.
Yeah, it's it basically just comprised of categorizing various different areas of my life. So it's probably about 10, you know. One would be work and the business, one would be finances, one would be friendships, one would be family, one would be things I wanted to, new skills I wanted to learn, for example. And I would score them 1 to 10. Mm. And then I would say 3, or you know, maybe even 2 things that I could do to put them up to 10, or to put them to better than where they were at that time. And then on top of that, I would go through all of them. And then I would say, right, for the next 3 months, which are the 1 or 2 or 3? I mean, I would, you know, me, from what I've said, I would start with like 4 and then slowly over time work down to about 1 or 2. What are the 1 or 2 things I'm going to focus on for this next 3 months, 3 to 6 months? And slowly breaking those things down into bite-sized chunks was key to actually making sure they happened. And I still am guilty of trying to do too much. So I'm always just like, start with one thing, tick it off the list and then go on to the next thing. And I think where it's habits as well, I'd really encourage people to start with one and really wait until that habit's bedded in. So, you know, I think it's probably say 28 days for a habit to be bedded in. I think that's probably all the data shows. But even then, I would say wait 3 months, like wait until that habit's really bedded before you start trying to do more, because I think it's much better to go one step in the right direction rather than take three steps forward and end up taking four steps back.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, what you're talking about there is a sort of it's a sort of classic coaching tool, but it's a great, as you say, a personal planning tool as well. It's the wheel of life, effectively, where you kind of go, you know, life comprises things like finances or career or personal relationships or social life or health or spirituality. Where do I sit right now, honestly, on a scale of 0 to 10? And where you are most adrift, you think about what your 10 out of 10 would look like. And you just need to think about what's the one thing I could do if this segment matters to me. Because for some people, not every segment matters, you know, or they're already at 10s. Or spirituality might not that be important, but, you know, career and family might be. So you go, where am I adrift for my 10 out of 10s? And what does that 10 out of 10 look like? Which of these really are important to me that I, such that I want to address them first? And what's the one thing that I could do to move that 3 to a 5 or a 7 or a 9 or a 10? And then just focus on it. And as you say, I think focus, I'm the same, focus is the hard bit, but it's, you focus on that until you feel the impact. And yeah, it's an incredible experience, because it is literally, what does my ideal look like? And now that I've got that space and focus, I'm going to try and create it, which is fantastic. And I know from having spoken to you before, you know, this interview today, MUSH, which I really want to talk to you about, that would have fitted into a number of segments in the traditional wheel template for you. You know, your sort of meaning and purpose, health, as well as career and business. So can we talk about MUSH for a while? Because I know obviously that's where you've channeled an awful lot of your energy. So talk to me about that.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I think for me, a lot of MUSH is probably a blend of some of my personal values. Well, it certainly is a blend of my personal values. And then in terms of the mission more broadly, my overall why, I still am defining. I know that for me, it's really important helping people in some way, but I, you know, what that exactly looks like over the broader length of my life, you know, I think that sort of moves and changes. But for now, the focus for me is MUSH and the mission that we have, which is bridging the gap between taste and function, and really focusing specifically on the people that we think we can help, which is what we define as the tastemakers. So people who look for good taste in drinks. That is still, when you look at the survey data, taste always comes out on top in terms of what people look for in drinks, but also people who are thinking about sobriety, whether they're sober curious, whether they're thinking about moderation, or, you know, whether they're just thinking about one night where they're not going to drink with their friends and everyone else will do. So it's people at all sorts of different sort of parts of the spectrum. We've been working on the business for 2 years now. The momentum, the pace, the speed is picking up, and we're slowly bringing more people into the team. Our full-time team is 4. We've got our production and distribution partners up in Cambridge. They've got another 4. And then we've got various agencies and freelancers who also support us. And we're likely going to be hiring at some point in the near future as well. So yeah, lots of exciting things happen. As you said, there's a massive crossover for me between the mission of MUSH and my sort of personal mission, or my personal why. And the values, again, this is big crossover. So I think, you know, there's a danger at times of blurring personal and business together, which I, again, is a line that I try and tread. But in terms of those values, if I run you through them, so boldness is super important. I think doing things that are different, doing things that are scary, you know, even doing this podcast today, it's not necessarily something that I've done a lot of before, but I love the opportunities. I love to try different things. And I think boldness for me is excitement in life. We need that excitement. And it's why I love working with my business partner, because he pushes us out of our comfort zone all the time. He's off recording an interview with Simon Squibb currently. And that's just him. He sees an opportunity, he just goes for it, which is great. So boldness is important. Kindness is also incredibly important to me, because I think it's hard to be bold. It's hard to do those things if we can't be kind to each other, if we don't respect each other in the right way, we talk to each other in the right way, and if we can't facilitate meaningful conversations and offer that kindness to understand each other. I think that's ourselves,
to be honest. You know, kindness to ourselves as well. You know, you can put yourself out on a limb and take risks when they don't work out. You've got to talk to yourself nicely, don't you? treat yourself nicely.
And I think that's sometimes the difficult thing of balancing that kindness to yourself, but also the kindness to others. So again, you know, lots of balances to strike. And then finally, authenticity. So for me, that authenticity means working on a mission that I really, really believe in. You know, I could have stayed in a job that was for a very good company that's doing amazing things, but there was this just small thing, noise in my head, which was saying to me, actually, is there a mission that could better align with what you want to do? And ultimately, that was what starting work in my first business to moving into Mersch was slowly figuring out what that looked like. And alcohol really allowed me to start figuring out what that was. So I want to be surrounding myself with people who can be authentically themselves, are working on problems that they really care about. Because I think when things get really hard, if you are authentic and you are focusing on things you care about, that's what drives you through.
Yeah, no, it is. It undoubtedly is. You have a why that is motivating. And particularly, you know, it's great to sit there at the beginning of a venture and go, yes, this feels noble, but actually it's got to hold you up. It's got to hold you up when things get tough. It's got to be the thing you go back to and go, oh God, I remember why I'm getting out of bed every morning. Yeah, got it. Or you know, when an investor doesn't invest or whatever it might be, you kind of go, onwards we go, because this is a really important mission and a really important why.
When an investor doesn't invest, if you know, you're trying to bring on board a brand ambassador and they say, actually, it's not for me, or it's too early, when you don't get stocked in somewhere that you're trying to get stocked in, when, you know, things go wrong for all whatever reason, things happen all the time. When you're working through
all
the week,
the same day.
Yeah, it happens all the time. And I think, you know, if you're not passionate about it, if you don't love the thing you're doing, and passion comes in so many different ways and so many different missions, right? So it means very different things to different people. But for me, every time, it's not even a question. Like, I'll recognize the fact that I'm going through something difficult again, but there's not really a question in my mind, because I just know that I believe in it. And I don't know what the future holds, but I know that the mission that I'm on right now is one that I'm passionate for. And I know that I'm working on the thing that I want to be working on.
Yeah. And I love that, because had you still been in the drinking mindset, you probably wouldn't have sat down and had those conversations. You wouldn't have listened. You wouldn't have intuited or followed any depth of, you know, conversation you were having with yourself. You just don't have the space and time and I suppose clarity and emotional literacy as well to do that. I think when you're on a sort of a drinking treadmill, I think, you know, what I really like about the conversation we've just literally had, those you know, that topic there, was that, you know, meaning doesn't have to necessarily live in big goals and ventures. It can do. I mean, Mersch is very much a sort of a vehicle, you know, for your own values and your mission. But you mentioned earlier as well the small pleasures, the sunsets, the meals with friends, the walks on Wimbledon Common, the time with the family, the solo trips to the cinema. You know, there's time for both, and it's about that balance as well that often you have to have that sober clarity in order to be able to sort of obtain that and have the energy to do it all. Can I just ask you something? I know this is sort of personal. You mentioned a moment ago about therapy, and we've probably got about sort of 5 minutes or so left. And I just wanted to talk to you about inner work. We had on the podcast quite a long time ago now, a guy called Alex Clapp, who got himself into a hell of a pickle. He ended up going off into rehab and doing the work within a sort of rehab environment. And not everyone who listens to this show clearly needs rehab. Not anyone who needs rehab can often afford rehab, but there's always work that we can do on ourselves. And I think, you know, Alex said to me at the time, it always stayed with me. He said, you know, if I truly believe that if we all down tools for sort of a month and did the kind of work that rehab presses on us to do, sometime out of need, the world would be a better place. We would understand ourselves better, we'd understand other people better, and we would just be kinder, nicer people. And I really, I mean, I think it's quite a profound thing to say. I think it's very true. You've mentioned therapy, and within that context of therapy, you've obviously done some work on yourself. I don't intend that you share, you know, personal insights and stuff, but it's obviously helped you. It's, you said it's been profound and interesting.
Yeah, massively, massively, massively so. I think even just the process of going to therapy, whatever things you're trying to deal with, just the process of it helps think about, process and articulate how you're feeling. And I think particularly as men, we don't necessarily have the space to do that. I know a lot of my guy friends, a lot of it will, hanging out will be just taking the piss out of each other, right? And that's great. And there's a time and place for that. But there's also a time and place for having those deeper conversations in a safe environment and working through issues. And if you can't talk about those issues, then and sometimes you can't even, you don't even know what those the impact that those issues have and how that's making you feel, it's very difficult to work through it. And I think we take a lot of the burden ourselves and think, oh, you know, I've got these issues, it's my responsibility to solve
them. I should be able to sort it out. I should be able to. Yeah.
And I think recognizing that there are trained professionals out there who can help you do these things and help you do them. You know, I mean, there's not a particular time frame. Everyone's different, but leaning on that resource is okay. And it's very, 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 very helpful. And I think the other thing for me that really helped push that process ahead was seeing various friends of mine. You mentioned rehab there. I've had friends who've been to rehab for drinking, for other things. I've had friends who have done therapy before me for various different issues, alcohol and non-alcohol related, and all sorts of other things under the sun. And hearing their positive experiences and also seeing some of them quit drinking, it really made it much easier for me. And I think where people haven't got friends or people that they know who are facing these issues, I would imagine that most people do have friends who are that stage, maybe not the stage of quitting drinking, but looking at the data that we look at, it seems like, you know, I think I saw this 65% of Gen Z are now trying to reduce alcohol, 55% of people more generally from the data that we've seen. So there are these people out there. There are lots of communities, sober communities. There's lots of content. There's, you know, your excellent podcast, various other resources out there and communities out there. And I think having people around you who are on the same journey as you, but be it at different stages or similar stages, is so, so helpful in regards to those things.
It's so helpful. And I think, you know, it's a little bit like you don't have to be on a rock bottom with alcohol in order to quit. You know, it's, again, it can just be a prompt to say, is my life good enough? Are there things I need to out? I genuinely think the same with therapy. You don't have to be in a terribly low place in order to, you know, seek out conversations that can help. If you're sitting there with burdened by thoughts or, you know, concerns that you think you should be able to sort out on your own, but they're just not going away, then the chances are you do need a little bit of help. And it's just conversations as well. I mean, I've got along with a coaching friend, Tabin, we run a community, a coaching community, and it is about becoming unstuck from alcohol. Of course it is. But, you know, day in, day out in that community, the sort of the chat and the conversation is about life. And it's about, you know, the things that bring about the feelings that might then be met with alcohol. But it's not about, we're not sitting there chatting about alcohol all the time. We're talking about human beings, challenges, life, and we're solving each other's problems. You know, one little conversation at a time. And it's so empowering. And I'm a big fan. I'm a big fan of anything sort of therapeutic, talking therapy, whether that's formally, you know, with a psychotherapist or, you know, a really lovely community that you feel safe in.
And sometimes friendships can do those things for you as well. I think, you know, that's one thing that I've realized. A very good friend of mine, he actually called me on, I think it was Saturday. And we just had a chat for probably about an hour, talking about various things that we were both going through. And I've known this guy for, probably about 25 years, maybe even more than that, since we were seven. And I can tell you that we would not have been having that conversation at the age of 18 or even at 25. But the shift has been huge. And he was one of the people I mentioned who he went to therapy, you know, a year ago, and he's considering going again. And I think the way that he's been able to communicate his emotions differently showed me that that was possible. And, you know, we wouldn't have been having this conversation in the way we're having it a year ago.
No.
So even then, you know, quitting alcohol might have been the start of this journey, but there's still transformative changes that can happen. And I'm sure there will continue to be for the rest of my life and for the rest of most people's lives.
It's amazing. So we're going to have to wrap up because of timing. We've talked about so much. It's probably an unfair question to ask you, but what would be the one piece of advice that you would leave listeners with if they're teetering on the edge of, I think my drinking's awful, but it might need a little bit of a sort of a rethink?
My one piece of advice, and I'm going to use our Mush tagline, one small step. So I think just take one small step. You know, we talked a lot about loads of different ideas, loads of different things you can do. And I think as human beings, we naturally throw ourselves all in and want to change everything. But for me, it's like, what is that one small thing you can do? Whether that be try not drinking for the next weekend, for the next week, for the next month, and just trying that process, seeing how it goes, and checking in on yourself, and just do one thing. Don't try and do too much. So that would be my parting piece of advice.
Brilliant advice. Dan, I've loved this conversation. Thank you so much. I think listeners are going to take a lot, actually, from your honesty. And the way that you framed nourishment, ultimately, which is, you know, not just about food and health and, you know, your drinks brand, but purpose as well, you know, and balance and you know, daily joys. So I love this because I think it's a cracking example of changing the narrative. And instead of asking whether your drinking is so bad that you need to do something, it's about saying, is my life good enough? And that at the end of the day, you know, we've got one shot at this, haven't we? We've got literally one shot. We're not going to get it right, but we can certainly have some intention about making it as good as it can be. So, yeah, I thank you very, very much for your time. I know you're a busy guy. And thank you very much indeed for coming on and sharing your thoughts.
Yeah, thank you, Anna. I've really enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you for listening and getting curious. Please rate, review and follow this podcast on Apple or Spotify or wherever you're choosing to listen. And don't forget to tune in to the next episode. And you can find out more about The Big Drink Rethink by heading to my website, thebeliefscoach.com. That's the Beliefs, BELIEFS coach.com, where you will see clear links to the show.